Alternative programming on HD 2 and 3. KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Falinski.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And tonight on Queer Voices, the Houston GLBT Political Caucus is celebrating its 36th anniversary with a special reception Saturday, June 18th, at the Magnolia Ballroom in downtown Houston. Founded in 1975, the Houston GLBT Political Caucus is the South's oldest civil rights organization dedicated solely to the advancement of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights. And the president of the Political Caucus, Noel Freeman, will be joining us shortly. In news wrap, dozens of couples got licensed in Illinois on the first day of that state's new civil unions law, while Connecticut and Nevada governors have each signed bills protecting transgender people from discrimination. And the San Francisco Giants have become the first professional sports franchise to contribute a supportive video to the It Gets Better teen suicide prevention campaign. After news wrap, June is Gay Pride Month in Houston. Here at Queer Voices, we will be looking at several Pride topics during the month. Tonight, we start off with the Pride Parade Grand Marshals, male, female, organizational, and honorary. And who are they, you might ask? Tammy Wallace, Tim Baker, Judy and Dwayne Rowland, and somebody called Brian Levinka. Gee, that name sounds familiar. But anyway, at 10 o'clock, Equality Texas is wrapping up the state legislative session and beginning work on the special session to ensure that the GLBT community is protected from anti-gay legislation. Equality Texas board member Terry Preston will be here with an update on the state issues and the current status of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. After Equality Texas, Skip Martin of the Houston Pride Band will join us to highlight the band's Pride concert, Americana. The concert will take place at Zilka Hall in the Hobby Center in downtown Houston this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. And then we have the feature segments from This Way Out Tonight. From writer-director Mike Miles comes Beginners, a comedy drama about an elderly widower played by Christopher Plummer who announces that he's gay to his son, played by Ewan McGregor, and that he plans to, quote, do something about it. This Way Out has interviews with actors and audio clips from the movie. And actually, I think even though it's spelled Ewan, it should be pronounced Ian.
It's Ewan McGregor.
Oh, no, I see.
From Scotland.
And I heard some really good stuff about that movie. In fact, Terry Gross did a great interview this past weekend and previous week on that. It's based on a true story. It's about a father whose wife dies, and at age 75, he decides to come out.
Wow.
Yes, really interesting.
Now, who's this Brian Levinka guy who's a Grand Marshal?
We'll see.
We'll have to see.
Yeah.
And probably spells his name differently.
Well, it is June, and June is Pride Month, so there are going to be a number of events that either are official or unofficial Pride events. The Outsmart magazine should be coming out shortly, and there should be a whole list, and probably it's already online.
It's online, but it officially arrives on stands tomorrow.
And I understand that the Pride organization is actually doing a paid periodical.
The Pride Guide. It's called Out in Form.
Okay, and when is that going to be available? Do you know?
Shortly.
Okay. Okay. So all that's happening, and Pride, of course, is happening all over the world. A lot of the Pride organizations, it happens in June. And the big ones are, of course, in New York and San Francisco, Los Angeles. Minneapolis has a very big one. Chicago, of course, Seattle. Those all happen in June. Oh, and of course, actually, I think Atlanta might have moved theirs. I'm not sure if they moved it back. They had a rough year a couple years ago, but they have a very big one.
And does anyone else have a nighttime parade?
Sydney, Australia does. And that's called the Gay Mardi Gras. And that happens in like February, March. And it's the largest event in Australia, except for when the Olympics shows up there. But that's how we got sort of the idea of doing the night parade here in Houston. They actually started their Pride Parade doing a night parade, and it turned out to be an incredible success. We'll see. And actually, this year they're moving up the start time a bit, so it's not going to quite be dark out. So we'll see how that works.
It'll be at 8:15 is when it officially starts.
Right, and it doesn't really get dark till about 8:30, 8:45. So we'll see how that all works out. I know they already had one of the mandatory Pride Parade meetings. There's going to be another one next week. So I understand they have lots of entries in it. So that all sounds really good. We'll have an update next week with the Pride Committee.
We'll have all the juicy details of everything from the Pride themselves, Pride
that's
organization.
Right. So all that's coming up, and let's listen to some queer music, and we'll be right back with our first guest.
Boy, the name of the song is Why, and it's from the album Twinkle You. This is Queer Voices.
This is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee. Brian, and
yes,
we
Jennifer.
Have a special guest in our studio tonight.
Well, Jennifer, all of our guests are special.
Well, that's true, but very special to me.
Extra special.
Very special. Someone that I have a great deal of respect for and a great deal of sensitivity for. I believe anybody that can be the president of the Houston GLBT Political Caucus is made of sterner stuff than anybody else. And we have with us...
I would have to agree. It's like herding cats, you know.
Oh, and the man of the hour right now is Noel Friedman. Welcome, Noel.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be on.
And he is El Presidente...
Very much so. And you've been doing some incredible stuff.
And we're only 6 months into the Freeman, I guess, administration.
That's right.
So, how's it going?
It's a lot of fun. I'm enjoying myself. And, I'm only a lightning rod every now and then.
Well, it happens. That's when you represent a quarter of a million, thereabouts, individuals who are friends and GLBT, it comes out that way. Everything you say is taken rightly and wrongly by everybody.
You're kind of the voice and face of the gay community.
And I've learned a little bit lately about everything you say getting taken one way or the other.
Oh, yes.
It's quite a good time.
Okay, so
especially when they get it taken it out of context.
Okay,
so context and you're all...
Now, for our listeners who may not know what the Houston GLBT Political Caucus is...
That's right.
What is that, Noel?
Well, you know, we've been doing a lot of research on our history lately, and... everybody said that the Houston GLBT Political Caucus is the oldest GLBT civil rights organization in the South, but that's actually partially true. Scholarly research shows that we are the oldest GLBT civil rights organization in the country.
Really? Now, how did this just come to light? I've heard this for years that we were the oldest in the South, but...
We've been looking through papers and documents, research that's been done through ARCH, GCAM, that's mm-hmm. at Gulf Coast...
Archive and Museum,
mm-hmm. ARCH, it escapes me.
Houston Area Rainbow Coalition of History.
There you go. And the Charles Botts Collection mm-hmm. as well. I spent some time over there looking at that.
And so you found that the caucus is now the oldest in the country.
In the country.
It would appear that way, and I would challenge anybody to come and prove me wrong. But
prove
me
wrong.
Well, just start saying it, and if it's wrong, somebody will show up to tell you.
Now, when did it start? How old is it?
It's been around since 1975. There was a press conference back in 1975 when a number of representatives came together from the GLBT community to announce the formation of what was then called the Gay Political Caucus. And it just grew out of that. There were a number of smaller gay organizations that were in the community, but the Gay Political Caucus grew out of that. Later on, became the Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, and now the GLBT Political Caucus.
And Ray Hill was there.
Yes, he was. I think he said that he wore a rust-colored suit so that when the photographers could balance their photographs, he would make sure that he was in the middle of the photograph.
I thought he served wine at the Last Supper.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I thought he was the dirt that God walked on.
We love Ray.
I've seen some very, very interesting pictures of Ray. There's some good stuff out there. It really is.
Very handsome person, and when he was young, he was really dynamite.
He still is.
Well, I'm just when he was young,
okay,
yes.
Okay.
When he was an evangelist,
he's still handsome. So
I didn't say he wasn't.
Okay, so the caucus is the oldest organization in the country, civil rights organization. What do they do? The caucus.
Well, we do a lot of different things. And one thing that a lot of folks don't realize is that the caucus consists of two completely different organizations. We have the caucus, which is the umbrella organization, and there's the Political Action Committee. And we're most well known for our Political Action Committee, which endorses candidates. Well, first we screen them, we give them a hard time, make sure they're good on our issues, make sure they're good, viable candidates, and then we endorse in elections and work to get out our vote. We put volunteers at polling locations. We send out our card that a lot of folks are familiar with. Tens of thousands of people are familiar with. But on the caucus side of things, we do issue advocacy, education. Surprisingly, we do a good amount of what we would call constituent casework, and that is people who have problems out in the community, they don't know who to turn to. Well, we've been around forever, so they call us, and we try to help them through some of their issues, whether that's refer them to other agencies or step into things on our own.
So that's the education portion, I guess?
Yes.
The 501c3 portion, if we want to...
Well, it's not a C3. It's a C4.
It's information, education, and advocacy.
Right.
Okay.
And there are two parts. So the C4 and then the PAC.
Yes. Okay. C4, for listeners who don't understand what we mean when we say C4, because we say that a lot.
Yeah.
C4 is a 501 section C4 in the Internal Revenue Code, which classifies us as a nonprofit organization. Now, it doesn't mean that we're a charitable organization, because you can't write off contributions to the caucus for charitable contributions on your taxes. But if you own a business and your contribution to the caucus qualifies as a business deduction, well, then that's what a C4 is helpful for.
Oh, I see. That's a good thing for our listeners to know. Now,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you learn something on Queer Voices all the time. Now, Noel, we're coming into an election. How is the caucus getting ready, and what are they doing to prepare for this election?
Well, we have already jumped into the mayor's race. We sent out questionnaires to all the announced and some suspected potential mayoral candidates, and we screened Mayor Parker and offered that opportunity to other folks, and we have endorsed Mayor Parker for re-election.
Yay!
Now, the city council and the controller candidates, what we did is we said we'll wait 30 days from the day that the new redistricting map is set by city council, give people a chance to get off their butts and get into the race so they can prove that they want to be competitive. And on the 18th of June, we're going to issue the questionnaire out to folks. We're going to invite them to screen with us. We'll put that questionnaire up on our website. We invite them over for interviews, and then we'll have our big, wonderful meeting in August. And this questionnaire, let me tell you, is 48 questions. It's like none they've ever seen.
That's crazy. So, like, what type of questions?
Well, we want to be able to really examine qualifications. You know, are they qualified to serve as elected officials? Do they know what they're doing? Do they know how to run an effective, viable campaign? Do they understand how our city works? Do they understand what the pension systems are? Do they understand how they operate? Do they understand what the bigger issues are? And most importantly, are they good on our issues? Do they understand our issues? Are they friendly to our issues? Are they educatable on our issues?
What are some lightning rod questions that would kind of separate the wheat from the chaff on our issues?
Well, I don't want to give anybody potential unfair advantage, but I would say...
Well, only the people out here listening.
We only have two.
I would say that there are some pretty tough questions about how our city operates and the things that our city does that affects the GLBT community on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, people think that it's easy to look at things like same-sex partner benefits, non-discrimination.
Those are
the really big things that people point to. But there are things that the city deals with on a daily basis, things like housing funds for people living with AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
AIDS... medication programs.
Right.
There are a lot of different things out there. I mean, you look at the issue that happened with Covenant House.
Mm-hmm. With the transgender.
Know, I'm happy that they're on the path to getting non-discrimination worked in permanently into their policies. But, you know, there was a study that came out today that shows that gay youth are 3 to 5 times more likely to kill themselves than their straight counterparts.
Well, yeah, why is that?
It's because of the things that they put up with. I mean, there's a lot of talk about bullying lately, but really that is a lot of it. I mean, it's hard to go through that struggle. You know, if they get kicked out of their homes, they're more like 8 times more likely to become homeless than straight youth, and that's between the ages of 12 and 18. I mean, the numbers are really, really astounding, and those are things that we want to make sure people know about. It's part of what we do and part of our education.
And part of that is especially if they happen to be transgender youth. None of up until this recent change in Covenant House would turn them away, and most of the other agencies have for many years turned them away. So they ended up homeless and committed suicide on the street.
It's a very, very tough situation to
Okay, do. So you send out the questionnaires, and then do the members go through them, and are they a part of the endorsement process, or how does that work?
Our members volunteer to serve on screening panels, and they come together and they interview candidates, and they ask them questions about their questionnaire and questions about issues that are important to them. If there are things that need clarification or specific pieces of information we didn't ask for, that we want to know about, then that's their opportunity to do that. They score them. We tally up the scores. Those are presented to our membership at the big endorsement meeting, and then we vote on the endorsement.
And then once they're endorsed, what happens? How is that a special thing to the candidate? I mean, what's the benefit of being endorsed?
Well, our job is to get out votes for our endorsed candidates. And so we unleash an army of volunteers on the city of Houston. We get our endorsement card out. We put our media machine to work. We make sure that we get that message out, get the vote out. This year, I'm actually planning to spread out outside of the normal ground that we typically cover. I want to be able to cover at least 3 or 4 early voting locations. I want to make sure that we've got a presence in at least the top 20 to 25 precincts that perform in the city of Houston on Election Day to make sure that we have a really strong presence out there.
And is voter turnout expected to be higher, lower? What are they expecting this year?
I haven't heard specific numbers for projections, but voter turnout does tend to be lower in off years. I mean, this is an off year in more than one reason, or in more than one way, rather. It's not a presidential year. It's not a gubernatorial year, and it's not a mayoral year. I mean, technically, you know, Mayor Parker's up for re-election, but the mayoral seat is not vacant. So voter turnout will be lower this year, and in 2 years, in 2013, we expect it'll probably be even lower.
So I think the message to our listeners is that this is an important year for our voters to come out and vote for the candidates that we endorse as a political caucus, and to make our vote carry more weight because there's less voters. I think that's the message I'm getting from that.
Absolutely. We have the opportunity to magnify our influence when we get out our voters in force in low turnout years.
Absolutely. Now, what is your vision for the caucus as president? Where do you see the caucus going on forward from this point?
One of the things I'm trying to do is to increase our presence in the community. I think we've gotten into a little bit of a lull. I mean, you look at the election between Steve Shiflett and Larry Bonnerice back in, God, it must have been 81 or 82. I'm probably getting that wrong. Somebody will correct me. But they had 504 people cast votes in that election for the president of the caucus. It's absolutely amazing that there was that kind of involvement. We haven't marketed our organization as well as we could have over the years, and we haven't made that distinction between the C4 and the Political Action Committee, so people think that it's all the same. All the money that they give to us goes to just political stuff, or it goes to just paying the rent. It's a lot of education that we've got to do. But I want to give the caucus a stronger presence in the community on some of these other issues that we have to go after. Houston doesn't have a non-discrimination ordinance. We did, but it got repealed back in 1985. Well,
yes.
We need to think about that again.
Yes, you could be fired in the city of Houston for being gay.
Yes.
No recourse. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the history of the caucus. Now, I understand that there's an event coming up to celebrate the anniversary. Tell us about that.
Yes, we are celebrating our 36th anniversary this year with a spring fling at the historic Magnolia Ballroom, which is over on Franklin Street. Bart Truxillo has been very generous to donate use of the facility for us in celebrating our 36th anniversary, and I'll give a special thank you to Sue Lovell for asking him to do that. Both very wonderful people, been involved for a long time. It's going to be a night of cocktails, dinner, and dancing. We've got our special guest, Maranice Parker, and we are honoring Pokey Anderson, one of the last surviving of the four founders of the caucus. We're very excited to have her back out here. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're very excited about that.
And when is that? What's the date of that?
That is June 18th. That's the first day of Pride. It starts at 7 o'clock with a VIP reception with our special guest. If you're a VIP, we'll give you a couple of free drinks and some past hors d'oeuvres. And the general admission's at 8 o'clock. And we'll have that, our presentation, and then dancing until 11.
I see. And that's the night of the Pride opening ceremony. So,
yes, it is.
So it's literally
at the same time that you're being honored.
No. It's offset.
It's after. You can go to the opening ceremonies, walk
right
5 blocks away.
Because I was like, hello, there's the Pride opening ceremonies. And they said, no, it's after that. So you can literally go to the opening ceremonies and then walk across the street. And it's like a block or so. I mean, it's
a couple blocks.
Jones Plaza to the Magnolia Ballroom and go to this. So it's going to be a prideful day.
So you can fit all of it in and make it a very busy day. Just dress
Let
up.
Let me tell you, I'm going to be running ragged.
Just dress up early and go the whole day.
Yes. Now, Where can they find out information about tickets?
Go to our website. It's www.thecaucus.org.
And you just redesigned that, didn't you?
We did. It looks great.
And I love it.
The first thing you see when you load the website is a special thank you to all of our sponsors, so you can see who's on board. People like Meteor, The Advocate, Outsmart, and the Houston Dynamo. Wonderful to have those businesses as sponsors. And you can either click on that slide or click through a couple of the other ones. It'll take you right to that page where you can get more information about the event, and you can purchase tickets or become a sponsor.
Is there anything else, Noel, that you would like our listeners to know about the caucus or the event?
Well, you know, the caucus is the driving force behind what the gay community grew out of back in the 1970s. It's been an integral part of our community for many, many years. And I want all of our listeners to come out, join us, and stand by our sides as we march toward another 36 years and beyond.
That's great.
Heck yeah. Sounds good to me.
Thank you, Noel.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
And this is Queer Voices.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 4th, 2011. As communities around the world mark the 30th anniversary this week of the first reports among gay men of what came to be known as acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, the quick resolution of a controversy over a poster promoting safe sex in the Australian state of Queensland also demonstrated the power of this decade's social media networks. The right-wing Australian Christian lobby had initially convinced the advertising company AdShell to pull down posters for a safe sex campaign at several Brisbane bus shelters that had been created by the Queensland Association for Healthy Communities. Rip and Roll shows two fully clothed men embracing, with one holding an unopened condom package. But after a demonstration outside its offices and more than 25,000 people joining a Facebook group in a matter of days to protest the removal of the ads, AdShell announced that it was putting the posters back up. Michael James, who appears in the ad with his real-life partner, had encouraged the protests. A press release from the company claimed that its management thought the complaints had come from individual members of the public. It has now become clear that AdShell had been the target of a coordinated ACL campaign, the statement said. This has led us to review our decision to remove the posters, and we will therefore reinstate them with immediate effect. Australian Christian Lobby, Queensland, Executive Director Wendy Francis said her group was opposed to what she claimed was the sexual nature of the ads, not the fact that they featured gay men. Last year, however, she was forced to apologize for sending a tweet comparing marriage equality to child abuse during a failed campaign for the Australian Senate. According to the Courier Mail newspaper, high-profile online supporters of the ad campaign included comedian Josh Thomas. Wendy Francis thinks hugging is foreplay, he tweeted. Remember that if you see her hugging her kids.
South Africa's Human Rights Commission announced this week that the country's recently appointed ambassador to Uganda, John Quillane, has been found guilty of hate speech for a Sunday Sun newspaper column he wrote in 2008, several months before his appointment, entitled, "Call Me Names, But Gay Is Not Okay." Commission spokesman Vincent Mwaga told reporters that a judge ordered Quillane to apologize and to pay a 100,000 rand fine, equal to about $14,000, which Mwaga said the commission would donate to LGBT rights organizations. Quillane reportedly did not contest the charges against him and has not, as of this report, issued any comment about the ruling. A spokesperson for South Africa's Foreign Affairs Department pointed out that Quillane's column was personal and was published before his appointment, so it's not anticipated that the veteran journalist will lose his ambassadorship. The South African Human Rights Commission's Mwaga said that the prosecution of Quillane sends an important message at a time when a series of rapes and other attacks on lesbians have raised concern about homophobic violence in South Africa. Even though gays and lesbians are protected from discrimination in the country's constitution, and marriage equality was established there in 2006, animus towards sexual minorities persists, especially in the townships. "We are hoping, really, that this finding will send a message to community members," Mwaga said of the Quillane ruling, "a message that says gay and lesbian people have an equal right to the protection of their dignity and rights." There have been no reports of official reaction in Uganda to the Quillane hate speech conviction, but lawmakers there may still vote on a draconian bill in the new parliamentary session to make private consensual adult same-gender sex a capital offense in some cases.
In what's being described as a world first, the tiny South Asian nation of Nepal has counted sexual minorities in its annual census of 5.6 million households. Vikash Bista, a spokesman for Nepal's Central Bureau of Statistics, described the new category of third gender as an attempt to engage the inhabitants of an essentially conservative country to open up to different points of view. Nepal's rapid march towards equality for LGBT people began soon after a democratic republic replaced an entrenched and autocratic monarchy. Private, adult, consensual, same-gender sex was decriminalized in 2007 by the country's Supreme Court, which also ordered an end to discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Sunil Pant, the founder of the LGBT advocacy Blue Diamond Society and the country's first and currently only openly gay member of parliament, applauded the Statistics Bureau action, which he said was spurred by his group's threat to go to court over the issue. "We had to put in a lot of pressure," he said, "to have the third gender counted in the census." Pant said that marriage equality remains among the major goals for LGBT activists in Nepal, but he called the census acknowledgement an encouraging step forward.
In other news, same-gender couples lined up at county clerk's offices across Illinois on June 1st, the first day that they could get the U.S. state's new civil unions licenses. There's a one-day waiting period before vows can be exchanged. So in addition to numerous private ceremonies, dozens of couples gathered in Chicago's Millennium Park on June 2nd for what was probably the state's largest mass civil union ceremony. The Chicago Gay Men's Chorus performed, and Illinois Governor Pat Quinn and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel addressed the gathering. The new law extends all the state's benefits and obligation of marriage, except the name, to lesbian and gay couples, and recognizes marriages, domestic partnerships, and civil unions contracted elsewhere as civil unions in Illinois. However, the same law will now recognize legally united gay and lesbian couples in divorce proceedings. A Chicago attorney reported that a local woman he represented wanted to end a same-gender marriage she had entered into in Massachusetts. She was unable to do that in Illinois because the state had not legally recognized her marriage. With the advent of the civil unions law in Illinois, she will now be able to file for divorce there.
The Connecticut State Senate passed a bill on June 4th to outlaw bias in employment, housing, and public accommodations based on gender identity or expression. As with its earlier passage in the Assembly, the vote was strictly along party lines, with no Republicans voting in favor of the measure. Democratic Governor Daniel P. Malloy has promised to sign the bill as soon as it reaches his desk. But Nevada's Republican Governor Brian Sandoval signed two more bills this week to protect his state's transgender citizens. He signed a bill in late May to ban bias in the workplace based on gender identity or expression. The two additional bills he signed this week provide similar protections in housing and public accommodations.
And finally, the 2010 U.S. baseball champion San Francisco Giants have become the first major professional sports franchise to record a video for the It Gets Better online campaign that aims to combat suicide by LGBT and questioning young people. More than 10,000 It Gets Better videos have been produced since syndicated columnist Dan Savage and his partner Terry Miller launched the project in September 2010. Lifelong Giants fan Sean Chapin, who's also a member of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, used Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube to promote his petition at change.org, urging his hometown team to participate. Chapin collected more than 6,500 signatures, and according to a story in USA Today, the Giants soon agreed. Social media played a huge role, Chapin said. It's the simplest way to foster a discussion and to unite people who have similar beliefs. The Giants' award-winning pitcher Barry Zito begins the video that also features about a half a dozen of his teammates.
Hi, I'm Barry Zito of the world champion San Francisco Giants. We all know how difficult life can be as a teenager.
We've all been there and have had to deal with the pressure to fit in and be accepted by our peers.
It's particularly challenging for LGBT teens who face adversity and intolerance in their daily lives.
We speak for the entire Giants organization when we say that there is no place in society for hatred and bullying against anyone.
There is no place for children and teenagers to feel isolated or like they have to end their own lives.
To all the kids out there who are struggling.
And we know it may seem hopeless right now.
But please know that you have an amazing future in front of you.
And an entire community in your corner.
We promise you, it gets better.
It gets better.
Se pone mejor.
Yo con Mario.
We promise you, it does get better. Please visit itgetsbetter.org for more information.
The LGBT Windy City Times reported this week that the Chicago Cubs will soon join the Giants by posting their own It Gets Better video. And 12-year-old Boston Red Sox fan Sam Madden launched an online petition similar to Chapin's on change.org urging his favorite baseball team to also step up to the plate. According to a news release, the seventh grader had been assigned a school project that could make a difference in the world. He thought of his uncle Chris, who died unexpectedly in January at the age of 43, and believed strongly in the importance of ending the bullying of LGBT young people and those perceived to be. "This is something I can do to honor him," Sam says. "Uncle Chris knew how much I love the Red Sox, and I think he would have been thrilled with the team making an It Gets Better video to support kids." And on June 4th, spurred by more than 9,000 signatures on Sam's petition, the Red Sox announced that they, too, will produce their own It Gets Better video.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 4th, 2011. Written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride. Read the text of this week's News Wrap online at thiswayout.org.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
This is Queer Voices.
Each year, there is a community-wide vote for the Grand Marshals to represent the community during Pride Month. And over the years, it used to be selected by a small committee, and then over the years, it sort of moved on to be a vote by the community. And now it's actually, you can vote online. So it is based on what is truly supposed to be a community-wide vote on who would best represent the community to do this. So there are four slots. There is the male, the female, the organization, and the honorary grand marshal. So I'm going to go from right here and ask you each to introduce yourself.
Hi, Jack. I'm Tim Brookover. I'm president of the Houston GLBT Community Center. We are the organization grand marshal for 2011.
And Tammy Wallace, and I'm honored to be the female grand marshal for this year.
And I'm Judy Rowland, and my husband and I are the honorary grand marshals.
And Brian Levinka, I am the male grand marshal for 2011.
So let me ask each that you represent, whether it's yourself or your organization, some of the things that that sort of brought you to this point in the community. And Tim, I know you've been on the show many times talking about the community center.
Yes, I have. Always happy to be here. Well, the center is extremely excited to have been voted the organization grand marshal this year, particularly because it is our 15th anniversary. The center was founded in 1996, so we are officially 15 years old this year. It's been a long road, as it is with a lot of our community endeavors, but we have a lot of volunteers and volunteer board members who work very hard on creating programs and services and activities for the community, and we are very proud that we've gotten to this point after 15 years and hope that we can represent the community well this year and also continue to grow in future years.
And let's be honest, the community center's had some struggles over the years.
That's putting it mildly, yes.
And and it's an all-volunteer organization, and, you know, there's a lot of organizations that are no longer with us that have just fell apart. So you've been involved a number of years and helped keep it together, and I guess what you're sort of focusing on now is doing programs.
The center is, the center is really focused on programs and services for the community, which, of course, seems like a logical thing. But the model for the Houston GLBT Community Center here back in the 90s was that the center would be a landlord for other community organizations, and that's the way the center would make its operating budget, money that the center would then use for programming. Well, that's a model that never really worked very well. Our community just doesn't have that kind of resources. And we had some tough years in there. I will be the first to admit there were some pretty dark days. In fact, there are some years when I was president the first time, back around the turn of the last century, where I'm really still not clear how we managed to stay open. But as a board, we really rededicated ourselves about 2 years ago and said, you know, we have a 15-year anniversary coming up. If we're going to make this work for the community, you know, dad burn it, let's make it work. And how are we going to do that? Well, we're really going to focus on, one, not being a landlord, because that's not working for us. Let's just admit it. Let's focus on programming and services and programs, things that really help people, which at the time we kind of left because that seems self-evident for a center, but in some cases it perhaps wasn't. So since we've done that, I think we've had some great success. More support groups, including and weekly HIV support group, coming out support group, a lesbian support group, programs for seniors, more social and fundraising activities, including our monthly bingo game, which is also a fundraiser for our scholarship fund for GLBT students pursuing higher education. So we're just doing a lot more than we did in the past, and I'm hoping that, and I think the community really took notice this year, that, you know, hey, they're doing some good work over there, and they're really trying hard, and we certainly haven't gotten to maybe where we would like to be or where the community would like for the center to be, but I think we're doing some good work, and we're doing a good job.
And almost all those programs are free?
Almost all of our programs are free. In fact, the board made a commitment when we did, I guess you'd say, reorganize, that our support programs would always be free. That means the HIV support group, the coming out group, the lesbian discussion group, our programs for seniors, including the monthly potluck that we have, that those programs would always be free. There's a small charge for our monthly bingo game, which is a fundraiser for our scholarship fund and other center programs. And also, you know, it's bingo. You know, we're all used to paying for bingo. But most of our other programs are free. The picnics that we have and the socials, that's just something that we found that we like to operate that way, and the community likes it that way.
Tammy, what is your involvement in the community?
Well,
I don't know any of it.
You know, Jack, you and I have been in the trenches together. You know, in 2004, really 2002, 2003, I got caught up in a big layoff in corporate America and said, you know, at that point, what am I going to do? And what does my next career move look like? And what do I want to do when I grow up? And I had the good fortune to work with the caucus, and at the time the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby of Texas, because the caucus very much and the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby of Texas very much wanted to start the voter ID project that the caucus had been so faithfully doing in the years before.
And what is the voter ID project?
The voter ID project, identifying voters that would help us elect pro-equality elected officials, and we were able to amass many, many names in 2004 and 2005. 2006, I was a founding board member of the Houston Equal Rights Alliance and the executive director, served on the board member as a board member, vice president of the GLBT Political Caucus when we saw that organization through some difficult times and rebranding. But knocking on doors in 2004 when the whole marriage equality issue broke out, when our Republican president at the time opted to use us as a wedge issue in that political season, and I felt an important that we stand up and educate voters, and particularly in one House district here in Texas, about exactly what that meant for our lives and not being able to access our partner in the hospital, and just helping people to understand truly the impacts of enshrining that type of discrimination in our Constitution.
And that was, knocking on doors is tough work, especially in the weather here in Houston.
Yeah, it is tough work, and you know, I had volunteers that actually cut their teeth knocking on doors asking, what do you think about a potential constitutional amendment to ban gay and lesbian marriage? Now, I had cut my teeth many years before working on then our mayor. She, of course, was at-large council member and PVA, so knocking on doors wasn't foreign to me. But when you're knocking on doors in the political climate we had in 2004 asking what you think about this, now, what I'll say is we had a lot of volunteers come back and say, wow, people really do want to know more. They really want to understand. And it was a very positive experience for some. For others, just stepping out and knocking on that door was a huge victory, regardless of what the response was at the door.
Well, and it's sort of a coming out process, and I said, in a way that mm-hmm. you know what you believe, but actually trying to talk, you know, get your beliefs across to somebody else.
Right.
And even though I guess most of the area was Montrose or Montrose mm-hmm. adjacent, there's still Montrose is minority GLBT.
Right. And, you know, we were working in District 134, but we decided to branch out. We didn't stay just in Montrose where you think might be friendly. And it was in a lot of cases. But we were out in Braeswood near Rice University. We really tried to comb District 134 and look at those areas where we thought we'd have voters that didn't necessarily understand the issue, but they were open to learning more. And they certainly did not like the idea of putting this type of discrimination into what's our most important document in the state of Texas.
And looking back at that, do you think it was worth it?
Oh, it was absolutely worth it. I can pinpoint a specific point in time, and that was the night that Ellen Cohen was elected to represent us in Austin, and she subsequently became my boss. I had the great honor to work for her for 4 or 5 years. But the work that we did to identify voters, and we were able to mobilize working with her on the caucus to help get her elected in 2006. And those, you know, that's the beauty of the work that we did. So many of those voter IDs are now continue to live on in the database, and that's what helped get our mayor elected. And so, you know, all that work that we did benefits us and will benefit us well into the future.
Judy, tell me about yourself. I don't know you.
Well, my husband, Dwayne, and I are fairly new to Houston and new to the whole Pride event.
And where are you from?
We are from Indiana. We moved down here almost 6 years ago.
Okay.
We have two gay sons in Houston.
Yay.
And one of the first...
So they moved down here before you?
Oh, yes. One's been down here for about 18 years. The other one's for 15 years. One of the first things we did when we moved to Houston was join PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gays. It wasn't that we needed any help ourselves, but we wanted to get a group that we could go to freely and talk about our sons and hopefully help other people understand their children that are coming out. That's basically what got us into the Grand Marshal.
Now, were you involved in PFLAG in Indiana?
No. There was not one in our area. So we had no support group in Indiana. We kind of flew by the seat of our pants and read a lot of books and understood our kids because we love them.
And coming here to Houston, is that a whole different... In a major city like this? Is that...
Well, yes, sure it is. But we've been coming here ever since our kids came down. So, you know,
and how did they get down here?
Well, the youngest son came with a former partner right out of, almost out of college. They got tired of cold weather, so they moved down to Houston. And he did a few miscellaneous jobs until he finally found his niche at Legacy Community Health, and he's now the marketing director for that company. Our middle son Eric got a job down here with Continental. He left U.S. Air in Pittsburgh and came here to work for Continental Airline. So that's what brought them here. So we kind of followed.
And you like living here?
We love living here. We've always enjoyed Houston. Big cities don't, you know, frighten us. We love all the activities that go on here. We love the theater, the arts, the whole thing. Plus, we love being a big part of the gay community, and that was another reason that we wanted to come down.
Wow. And Brian,
yes.
I can't say I don't know you. tell me what your involvement in the community has been. Well, how did you start?
It started working to fight HIV and AIDS.
We're just celebrating the 30th anniversary of discovery.
I would probably not say celebrate, but we're remembering 30 years without a cure, and we're still kind of fighting it. I moved to Houston in 97, and about
three or four years later, I decided that I had to do something because a lot of my friends were either diagnosed HIV positive or had died. So I come from the portion of the generation that was most affected by HIV and kind of the bridge between the old and the newer generation that is not seeing as much death from HIV. So I joined the Bayou City Boys Club, and I worked through that for several years, and I started raising money for different organizations, and I landed on the Center for AIDS, and now I'm the board chair of the Center for AIDS. And that kind of started the activism portion of me, but it wasn't until I started doing the radio show that this radio show a couple of years ago that the activist gene kind of really took off in me, and I started seeing the many great organizations that Houston has and kind of trying to identify them and get them on the radio and kind of be this community voice for them. And my other kind of priority or passion has been political, and that all started in 2009 with Anise Parker. And I've kind of has lit the political fire within me, and I see that for our community to make a difference, to affect a change, is to be politically active and involved. Our people need to be in office, and we are no longer excluded from being the mayor of the fourth largest city. I mean, the glass ceiling has been broken, and you know, I'm hoping, and I work with the Victory Fund to kind of put those people in office, our people in office, so that we can see the change that we're fighting for.
Okay, what kind of change do you think electing somebody like Anise to the city has made?
Well, it has opened the door to a whole generation of gay Houstonians and gay Americans. I mean, just to see a positive role model in a position of power in a city, running a city through these tough economic times, despite being a lesbian. She is the mayor who happens to be a lesbian. She's not the lesbian mayor. And that has opened the door in so many ways. I know it's affected my life. It's affected just thousands of people around the country and around the world. It was international news.
Well, being one of the three people who founded Pride Houston back in the early 90s and taking it over from what the group was beforehand, and I've been away from 4 years now, and luckily I was elected Grand Marshal about 4 years ago when I left the organization. Is Pride still relevant? What do you all think, being a representative now of Pride in the community?
You know, Jack, I'll start first because that question was posed. Someone posed it that was interviewing us. And, you know, my answer was something along these lines. It's absolutely relevant. When we still have an environment where people can't come out at work, where we can be fired for being gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, yes, Pride is still relevant. When you still have kids that need to be on the sidelines and they need to see a celebration, they need to see, like Judy and Dwayne, PFLAG moms and dads walking down Westheimer and know that, yes, you are loved, Pride is absolutely still relevant. And every day it's relevant, but we need to celebrate it in June.
Pride is, first and foremost, a history lesson. When people ask, why is Pride in June? That's an instant history lesson in why we have Pride in June in Houston. It's relevant because there's a whole generation that are losing touch with our history. And every year in June, that we're reminded, it's an opportunity to reach out and connect to those younger generation of gays.
Well, and also, and I agree with all those reasons, and also something we discussed in that the interview that Tammy mentioned recently, was it's very relevant because we saw this year, and we're continuing to see this year in a political season, that our community is still used as a wedge issue. And we are still held up as the boogeyman, you know, if you'll pardon the expression. You know, oh, those gays, or oh, those GLBT people, or oh, those transgender people, they're scary and they're different. They're the other. They're coming to get you and coming to get your children. And I think many people in our community thought we were beyond that. You know, it's the era of Will and Grace and Ellen and, you know, much more visibility in the media. And we find that, yes, we've come a long way. Absolutely. And come a long way since, you know, since some of us were younger. But we're not there yet. You know, Ray Hill expressed recently in a posting, you know, you think you have all of your rights. Look how fast it can go.
It can go in an instant.
Mm-hmm. And you got to keep your eye on the ball. And one of the ways you keep your eye on the ball is you have pride, and Brian's right, it's a history lesson. Mm-hmm. And people need to be reminded of that history, and not just the young people, but even people my age, or, you know, even a little older. It's like, yes, there is a reason it's in June, and this is what happened, and this is why we celebrate or observe. Pay attention.
Pride is relevant until we have equal rights, period. Until that day, we should celebrate pride.
And what are you looking most forward to being going down that parade route? And I see you already got your medallions on. I guess you were instructed to wear them.
We just got them outside.
They were engraved with their names, so they just got back from the engraver. So we got them, and we're all proud Pride Grand Marshals.
Absolutely.
What am I most excited? I'm excited that I made a deal with my partner that if I won, if I was elected Grand Marshal, that he would have to ride in the car with me. And that is his worst nightmare. The idea of 200,000 people looking at him and him being the center of attention is absolutely the worst thing he could do. So I'm happy and proud that I was elected Grand Marshal, but I'm happy that he's going to be beside me in the car.
Sure.
Okay. Judy?
No, that's fine.
Well, and how do you feel about this? I mean, moving to Houston and all of a sudden being elected the honorary, Grand Marshal.
I didn't expect it, actually. This is not our first pride. We've walked in the parade for many times, even before we moved down here. We helped build floats with our kids for Continental and Outsmart when our son Eric was with Outsmart. And we've walked with the P-Flight group for the last 5 years. I'll kind of miss walking with the P-Flight group because we get such a huge response. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking forward to riding down the parade with my sons, and our granddaughter is coming down from Indiana, so she will be with us, and we're looking forward to it very much.
Well, great. I congratulate you all. It is a great honor to be elected, being in front of the parade, walking down there and having 200,000 people, cheer you on is a really, really neat thing. And for all those years I put on the parade, the actually being in that parade was just a whole nother experience. Mm-hmm. And knowing that there's 100 floats and contingents following you, that it is the center point of the community. It's like you can do all the work to put on the parade, but if nobody shows up, what good is it? But people do show up.
They do show up.
So congratulations, and I'll be looking forward to seeing you all.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jack.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Over the course of a meteoric music career that spanned the turbulent decades of the 60s and 70s, Phil Oakes saw the bright lights of fame and social justice in equal measure, a contradiction that eventually tore him apart. The Houston premiere of the film, Phil Oakes, There But For Fortune, traces the arc of Oakes' life, which paralleled that of the times, how the anger, satire, and righteous indignation that drove his music also drove him to dark despair. The documentary features interview and performance footage of Oakes, along with commentary by Joan Baez, Pete Seeger, Sean Penn, and others. Phil Oakes, There But For Fortune will screen at the Brown Auditorium Theater at the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston, June 30th to July 4th. More information at www.mfah.org/films or call 713-639-7515 or visit us on Facebook under Films at the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston.
Widely seen as the channel of reference for coverage of the Middle East and Global South, Al Jazeera English can now be heard on 90.1 KPFT. Al Jazeera English has become a world leader in the coverage of Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Europe, and the Americas. You can hear Al Jazeera English weekdays from 5 to 6 a.m. on KPFT FM and HD1, or at 9 a.m. weekdays on KPFT HD2. Al Jazeera English has received many awards for its reporting. With a staff of more than 1,000 from 50 different countries, the aim of Al Jazeera English is to provide independent and impartial news for an international audience. Again, you can hear Al Jazeera English weekdays from 5 to 6 a.m. on KPFT and HD1, or at 9 a.m. weekdays on KPFT HD2. Visit kpft.org for a complete program schedule. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
When you tune into KPFT, you notice something right away.
No ads.
KPFT is a non-commercial radio station. We don't accept advertising or underwriting from businesses, nor does KPFT receive payment for any program we air. KPFT further disallows product plugging or endorsements. We do this because you, the listener, deserve access to the radio you love.
Without all the commercials, taglines, and cross-promotion that corporate radio subjects you to.
If you ever hear something on KPFT that you have concerns about, please contact our program director at 713-526-4000 during regular business hours. If you enjoy this kind of option on Houston's airwaves, become a member. KPFT is able to stay commercial-free because listeners like you make a pledge of support to keep us on the air. Your pledge is important. Call our membership department at 713-526-4000 or visit kpft.org to support KPFT with a pledge. Jason, can you give us that number again?
713-526-4000 or kpft.org to become a member.
KPFT, Houston.
Don't think you can make a difference? Be part of a movement that can revolutionize the radio station you know and love. By joining KPFT Sustainer Program, you can support your station and help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. What's a sustainer? Rather than giving a yearly gift, sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving $20, $100, or $500 monthly helps change the way KPFT operates. From having to meet our operating expenses through days and days of on-air fundraising, to friends of the station boosting it off-air throughout the fiscal year. Contact our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our sustainer program. Did you know sustainers can ultimately give a gift that is substantially larger than annual givers? That means less pledge drive, more efficiency, and greater stability for KPFT, regardless of the time of year. Again, just call our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our sustainer program. Make a difference today. This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
And this is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee, and we're back. Remember, last week we had Daniel Williams on, and
yes,
we talked about his blog about some of the things that went on in the legislature.
Which is a great blog that talks about, it's called Legislative Query. Gives you all the details of all the...
One of the things he talked about at that time was Equality Texas and what Equality Texas did up there at the legislature. So
that.
We followed up with that. The segue is we have with us Terrell Preston, who is with Equality Texas.
He's a board member.
Board member. But also, the last time we had you on, you're a former Air Force. And we're very instrumental in Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and very active in having it repealed. What's the status?
Well, first of all, thanks again for having me on. I love coming to see you for these Queer Voices interviews. And, Brian, good to see you again. Great seeing you both at the HRC Gala last Saturday. And,
yes.
And a council member candidate, Jennifer Poole, good seeing you again, too. Thought I'd put that plug in for you. But, yes, the last few times I've been on, we've talked about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And, of course, I was a 26-year veteran of the U.S. Air Force, retired colonel and fighter pilot. And so when I retired, it became very clear to me that we needed to change the law. We need to make sure that the gays and lesbians who are so patriotic and serving on active duty are allowed to do that openly. So when I retired, I worked really hard with Service Members Legal Defense Network, HRC, and some other groups to try to get the law changed. And I had a very small piece of that effort, but it was changed last December. We did repeal the law, and the new law, of course, is will take effect some period after the troops are trained to accept this new situation, and the president, the secretary of defense, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs certified that military readiness will not be impacted. And so we're about halfway through training the troops. Probably in the next month or so, we'll see the services report to the Secretary of Defense that the troops are trained. And after that happens, then the President can send the note to Congress that says, we're going to certify this is safe to do, and then you can repeal the law 60 days later.
Now, there was a hearing that, what was it, California Representative, he called it and he brought all of the joint members of the Joint Chiefs in there and got them in there, and it was almost like he was orchestrating what they were supposed to say. How did that? I saw his face get red on TV.
Well, what happened was, of course, the Republicans took the House of Representatives in the last election, and the House Armed Services Committee is now chaired by Representative Duncan Hunter, a Republican from California. And he's not a repeal advocate. He would like to see the repeal repealed. And so he decided that the last time they had the four service chiefs, the four-star generals and admirals that run each of the services, in to testify last year, all four of them said, maybe we should hold off on the repeal. Let's don't do this yet. We've got two wars going on. And so Duncan Hunter remembered that, and he said, let's invite them back so we can stop this repeal action. So he called them back in. They all sat down and testified. And his questions were, shouldn't we stop the repeal? And they said, well, the law was changed in December. We're full steam ahead training all the troops to accept this new law. And by the way, it's going very well. And so
happy with that.
They sort of thwarted his effort. He thought they were all going to back him up. And actually, they pulled the rug out from under him and said, no, it's going very well. We're on track. In fact, the Army four-star said, it's going so well that I may certify when I've only trained half the troops. That's how well it's going. I may do it early. So I think that the repeal action is on track. I think it may even happen a bit earlier than we expected. But I'm very encouraged by the report from the service chiefs.
Have you been in touch with the men in the field, the boots on the ground?
The boots on the ground, I love that.
When I was working through SLDN last year, that's the Service Members Legal Defense Network, whose sole mission in life has been to repeal this law for 17 years. We formed a special group of retired colonels and generals that I joined. 25 of us, gays and lesbians, went to the Pentagon. Most of us were very high-ranking folks who had commanded 1,000 people or more in the field, including in the wars, like I did in Operation Desert Storm. And we went and we talked to the committee that was actually setting up the repeal action for the Secretary of Defense. They have to write new regulations on how things will be dealt with. And we sat down with them. And, of course, they wanted to know how in the world they were going to do this. And so we said, well, one thing we've done is we've actually created sort of a secret network, a clandestine network of gays and lesbians in the military who trust us. And we know who they are, and we have emails with them all the time. So we have direct feedback from people in the field who are living as gays and lesbians in active duty. Sometimes they're living a sheltered or a secret life. Sometimes they're out to their colleagues. And some communities are more receptive than others. The medical community, for instance, really doesn't care one way mm-hmm. or the other. Some of the combat units, some very macho units, cared a little bit more. But as it turns out, when they surveyed the troops last summer, they sent out 400,000 surveys hoping to hear back that nobody wanted the repeal. About 100,000 came back, and they were overwhelmingly supportive of letting the gays and lesbians serve openly. Most of the soldiers said, we already know who they are, we like them, we've been to war with them, and they're watching our back.
You know, that's good to hear, because that's been, you know, they're training the troops to accept the new situation as far as the open acceptance of the gays and lesbians in the military. But, you know, that's still, there's always that undercurrent that I'm afraid of.
You know, there always has been. Every time we've made a change, whether it was to integrate African Americans or put women on ships, there's going to be some small percentage of your service folks who are really opposed to that. And like Secretary Gates has said to the troops on numerous occasions where he's flown to Afghanistan or Iraq to be with the troops, and that question's come up, he said, there's no tolerance for that. This is going to be the law, and this is what we're going to act on. And some people have said, well, if we're really opposed to letting gays and lesbians serve openly, can we get out of the service early? He said, absolutely not. Oh. You serve your hitch.
Oh, given yeah. some...
And in gay yeah. terms, that's ooh, snap.
Yeah.
Ooh,
but I
yes.
will say one more thing about the House Armed Services Committee. Even though the service chiefs gave a glowing report of how well the training's going, and now they're all in favor of it, Representative Hunter still thought that they should be involved in making the decision whether or not it be certified. And they said, no, please don't do that. Don't bother with that. The Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs know what we want. He did it anyway. So he did that amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the Pentagon's budget, and he also threw in two more poison pill type amendments to the NDAA. One was, it had to do with the recent controversy about chaplains marrying gays in states that allow gay marriage.
Right.
And so he put an amendment in there that said that they can't do that. And in fact, you can't have any gay marriages in the chapels on the bases.
Oh, also, wasn't it DOMA?
And also, the third amendment that he threw in there had to do with the military must uphold DOMA.
They must uphold DOMA.
Yeah.
Even though the government is no longer...
exactly.
He's the only part of the government that's upholding it.
No, that was a strict party line vote in that committee, but it really hasn't gone anyplace else. So,
you don't expect that to... these amendments to go through, or the DOMA ones?
They might go through the House, but of course the Senate would never entertain those because it's dominated by Democrats. And then, of course, the President would probably veto something like that, so I don't think there's any chance.
Well, good. In other words, don't ask, don't tell is gone.
I think it's on the way out. I mean, I've got a lot of...
But you can still be discharged.
Yes, in fact, somebody was recently an Air Force airman, which was what we call one of the lower-ranking soldiers in the Air Force. An Air Force airman, in this case, he was discharged, but he'd asked to be discharged. You know, a lot of times the gays and lesbians self-identify because the environment is a little hostile and there's a lot of anti-LGBT jokes going on. Sometimes they just kind of give up and they say, you know what, it's just not for me, I want out. And this is one of those cases. And so I don't know all the details about why he wanted out, if it was that or if it was something else, but in any case, it takes the Secretary of the Service to approve these discharges now. That's how elevated it has to be.
Wow.
And it's the only one that has happened since Obama signed the law in December.
Well, one more question about that, and that is that I was in the service, well, like yourself, you retired, but I'm in the service. I was outed by someone. They discharged me. They repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Can I come back?
Yes, you can.
Well, I want everybody to know that. I had heard that, but I wanted to verify it with you.
You know, some of the most high-profile cases, like Major Mike Almy, that was one of the SLDN's front-runners, these folks would love to come back in and finish their careers. And there's a provision in the repeal law that says we will take a look at people who were kicked out under this law. As long as there's no other issues except the fact that they were gay or lesbian, we can bring them back in. Now, they'll have a break in service for the number of years they were out, and hopefully they're still young enough to be in the service, but they can certainly come in and finish their career.
So they can get the benefits that they'd earned.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the big issue with a lot of folks is, hey, I was halfway to getting a pension and my medical benefits, and you pull the rug out from under me, so I want to come back in.
What about, we hear the stories about translators and all being discharged with it because they were gay or lesbian. Are those people eligible to come back?
Sure, they sure are. You know, like I said earlier, as long as they don't have some other issue, like a criminal record or something like that, if the discharge was solely because they were identified as LGBT, then they probably can be considered to come back in.
Okay. Now, you had said something we were talking about, as I said, and you and I were talking before we got on the air. Quality Texas was very, very busy up at the state legislature.
Oh, we had a great year this year. You know, I've been a contributor to Quality Texas since I retired in 2004 and a board member since last fall. And the reason I really wanted to come on their board is because I saw this incredible track record that this group has done. It's a very small, efficient group, just a handful of staff members in Austin, 22 volunteer board members, and they just do magnificent work. And here's what they've done. Over the last five or six legislative sessions, and you know Texas, I know Daniel Williams has told you how the legislature works. It's every other year, it operates for about 5 months. In the odd years. And over the last five or six sessions, this group has battled anti-gay, anti-equality legislation, trying to keep the lid on that. And it's been like a stair step of killing off bad legislation to the point where in 2000, 2007 and 2009, there were no anti-equality bills that got into committees or passed in the state legislature. Until this year, incredibly, we had 12 pro-equality bills in committees. And, of course, about 5,000 bills go into the legislature. A few get put into committees to be considered and have hearings, and then only a trickle come out as passed bills. But we had a dozen pro-equality bills in all sorts of areas. and two were passed. We had a suicide prevention bill for kids in school that
was Garnett passed. Coleman's bill.
Exactly. And we also had the anti-bullying bill, 1942, that passed as well. So we've got two big success stories, two very important bills for the kids in school. And it has a lot to do with Equality Texas being in the legislature every day, talking to reps and senators about these issues that matter to us.
Now, I have a question. You said about a dozen. What was changed? We've got this supermajority of Republicans in both houses, or in the House anyway, up in Austin. But yet we had bills, pro-equality bills, getting to committee. How did that happen?
I'll tell you how it happened, Jennifer. You know, last year, Equality Texas contracted this Equality Poll 2010. And we did a poll among all Texans to find out how they felt about about a dozen different issues with the GLBT. And things like hospital visitation, bullying LGBT kids in school, all these different issues that really impact our community. And we were kind of worried that the things we hear on TV and radio from the conservatives were true, and that is Texans don't like LGBT, and we don't want things to be equal for LGBT. But guess what? The poll came back with these vast majorities of Texans saying, treat everybody the same.
And well, that's the real Texans feel that way.
Real Texans feel that way. And, I mean, you know, some of those poll issues like shouldn't a same-sex partner be able to go into the hospital and visit his partner who's in hospital when the parents who are estranged say, we never liked you, you can't come in. Well, 88% of Texans said, that's not right. You should be with your partner. You should be in that hospital by his side, helping them make the decisions. And so on a whole range of issues, Texans had vast majorities, except, of course, marriage equality. We're still below 50% on that one, but we're coming along.
Well, the fact that we're making headway.
Yes.
And especially when we were hit with a tsunami in 2010 and swept in all of these freshmen in the legislature, especially in the House in Austin, that there was a great deal of fear that they were going to run over the GLBT community.
Well, and so that's why we picked and chose the issues very carefully. Now, when it comes to bullying kids in school, that pulls on the heartstrings of every Texan, because you can be different for a lot of reasons. You can be too short. You can be too tall. You can have big ears. You can have different color skin. There can be so many things. You can be the wrong religion, or you can be LGBT. So this anti-bullying and suicide prevention really applied to all Texas kids. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it had such broad appeal and went so far. But even the other ones that didn't really reflected the fact that Texans are fair-minded. They're not as one-sided as you would think from hearing conservative politicians talk about us.
Now, both of those bills are on the governor's desk,
they sure
they
are, yes. They both passed the House and Senate, even with some modifications, and now they're both on Governor Perry's desk. And I think Daniel probably told you last time that he's got three choices. He can veto it, he can sign it, or he can let it go for, I think, 60 days. And if he doesn't sign it, then it becomes law anyway. So,
right.
So the clock's ticking on that. I think if they went in there last week in May.
We got a special session. We got a special session coming up. Actually, it's happening now. Is there anything that we need to be aware of, need to be watching for?
You know, the easiest thing to do is go to equalitytexas.org. There's a legislative button. Click that button and see what issues are popping up. The team over in Austin is canvassing the halls on a daily basis, talking to the senators and reps about issues.
Crackerjack. Yeah, they're Crackerjack.
They're Crackerjack troops.
It.
Yeah, they really are. And so the easiest thing, the best resource is equalitytexas.org. Go there, and there's so many things you can do. In fact, if you're thinking about being generous, even,
right.
You can go to equalitytexas.org. At the very top of the page, there's something that says Gill Match in green letters. And the reason it's so important is the Gill Foundation, which is a very generous foundation for LGBT, had told Equality Texas last year, if you can get 50 new $100 a month donors, we'll give you $25,000. And so for anybody that becomes a Capital Club member, then Brian's partner, who just did it a few weeks ago.
I hear.
So now they're a family of Capital Club givers. That's very nice. Then we'll get $500 for each person who does that. So it's a very good place to go to give money.
And to touch on that, Equality Texas is doing something for gay Texans that no one else is doing. They're out there in legislature identifying and stopping anti-gay legislation and promoting the pro-gay
legislation that's in our interest.
And you know, Brian, a lot of people say, well, what's the difference between HRC and Equality Texas? And I always tell them, well, I'm in HRC too, but HRC is for the U.S. Congress. That's national level issues. And then there's a lot of these Equality Federation groups like Equality Texas, Equality Maine, Equality California, mm-hmm. and they deal with the state legislatures. And in our case, that's a big challenge because we have a very conservative legislature.
We do.
And it really takes a lot of people right. on the ground to make a difference.
And in most cases, the state laws affect you more directly.
That's right.
So this is more closer to our hearts. And, you know, I feel like our community doesn't support it as much as it should, and it's not as well known. And I think that's the task of you and your fellow board members. And
well,
what we're trying to do is...
We've only got two board members from Houston. We'd like to grow that. Maybe I'll talk to you about that later. But we had a little fundraiser a few weeks ago that you and your partner attended. And we had about 60 or 70 folks come in, and we had a very generous outpouring of people who wanted to join us on a donation level.
You know, the most powerful thing of that day was having Asher Brown's parents speak, and I know that they've been to the state legislature, and they've become very involved politically, and, you know, it's such a strong voice to hear them speak about Asher.
Well, they are. David and Amy Chirong are just wonderful folks, very dedicated. They have the strength of lions when it comes to dealing with this issue.
I don't know how they do it.
You know, they have a story that will just melt you away. It's incredible. And we were fortunate enough to have them at the lobby day on March 7th in Austin, where we had 300 people show up from around the state to kind of descend on the legislature. And each of us had a team of people, and we went around and talked to six different reps and senators. And David and Amy were able to go talk to some key folks who we really needed votes from to pass some of these bills that we were after. And they just did a magnificent job.
Amazing.
And they're generous enough to also travel around the state and talk at different Equality Texas functions. They talked at our event that night a couple weeks ago. And they're just magnificent folks. In fact, they were so moved by that event that you guys attended a few weeks ago that they became Capital Club members, which is $100 a month donors.
Right.
You know, so it's just incredible folks.
Well, Terry, you're a busy man, and I know Equality Texas is close to your heart, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell is close, but what else do you have going on?
That's really my main emphasis, besides doing occasional projects for Human Rights Campaign. You know, 2009, I ran the Voices of Honor event at Hobby Center,
right,
where we had the guys who were kicked out of the military and made a PBS film. They came in, and we screened that with about 100 people. Last year, my big event with HRC and SLDM was to get Mayor Parker to sign a letter urging Congress to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
And they did.
Yeah. So
when can we expect to hear something on it?
I think that by
a certification.
I think by August we should have a very clear picture of the date that we'll be able to let gays and lesbians serve openly. So I can stay in contact with you. We can talk about what's going on, and when we hear something solid, I'd be happy to come back on.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Do the party poppers, and you know, we can have
we'll do a celebrate. Yes,
bottle of
that's
champagne.
It. Right there.
Hurrah!
I guess hurrah! We've been talking with Terrell Preston. He's a board member with Equality Texas. We've been getting an update on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and a couple of good pieces of equality-minded legislation that's now on the governor's desk. One way or another, if he doesn't veto it, it'll be law. Thank you, Terry.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And this is Queer Voices.
I keep looking for a place to fit where I can speak my mind. I've been trying hard to find the people that I won't leave behind. They say I got brains, but they ain't doing me no good. I wish they could. Each time things start to happen again, I think I got something good going for myself, but what goes wrong? Sometimes I feel very sad. Sometimes I feel very sad. Sometimes I feel very sad. Wasn't made for these times. Every time I get the inspiration.
permission to go change things around. No one wants to help me look for places where new things might be found. Where can I turn when my but what goes wrong? Sometimes I feel very sad. Sometimes I feel very sad. I guess I just was made for these times. I guess I just wasn't made for these times.
That was Susan Werner, and the notes on JD's website, by the way, the music provided here for us by JD Doyle, the notes on his website say this is a cover of something that the Beach Boys did, but I don't remember anything like that by the Beach Boys. But anyway, it's from the name of the song, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, by Susan Werner, from the album Classics, released in 2010. This is Queer Voices.
This is Jack Falinski, and we are going to be talking about the Houston Pride Band. With us in the studio this evening is Skip Martin and Jason Stevens. And you are, how long have you been with the organization?
I've been here, been with them for 4 years. This is my fourth concert at Zilker Hall. The first concert there was the 30th year anniversary.
This is Jason. I've been with the band for about 6 years now. Shortly after I moved here to Houston, found out about it and joined the band.
So you're relatively new to an organization that's been around a long time.
That's correct. Sure.
And I guess we all don't think about band organizations as much as we used to. Schools don't do that as much. They don't emphasize that. They don't have time to do it because they all have to worry about their task tests and stuff like that. Is it difficult to find people who still play instruments?
Sometimes. We've been blessed that Houston is a pretty rich a pretty rich musical community from all different kinds of community organizations all over town. So we're kind of in competition with a lot of them. So there are a lot of folks out there. It's finding our niche in the Houston area and having people come and join us and finding their home and their family with us. And it's a lot of fun. We have a really good solid core group. But we tend to be a little bit smaller than a lot of the other community organizations out there.
Are there band organizations around the country that identify with the community? Many of them, are they still?
We have, we're actually part of a larger organization called the Lesbian Gay Band Association that has over 30 member bands around the country.
Okay.
And then we even have some that are overseas in Australia, in Europe, that in every year we actually have an annual conference where we all get together and have just one big concert and get to visit and see each other, and it's always a great time.
Now, do you usually participate in the Pride Parade, or do you focus more on doing concerts?
Both, actually.
Both, okay.
Mm-hmm. We have a concert series where we give at least three concerts a year, and then in addition to that, we are part of the Pride Parade.
And so now you're performing at the big hall, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Down there. And how many years have you been doing that?
This is the fourth year.
And how has been the reaction?
It's pretty good. We're still growing our audience, But what's really nice is that we get to play in a nice professional hall, good acoustics. We have, and we'll have professional recording engineers that record our concerts for us for archival purposes. And it's just really nice to give our audience and our members a treat to actually play in a professional hall as opposed to, you know, playing in churches or right, in, or right. out on the street for the like AIDS walk or for the parade. So it's a nice treat, nice change of pace, and we're getting a little spoiled, I think. We really like it.
Yeah. It is a beautiful hall, you know, and we're lucky to have that here in Houston.
Absolutely.
In fact, a very close friend of mine used to say, and he's been in New York and San Francisco. He lived there, and he says he really appreciates the facilities we have down here because you don't always think of Houston as being, well, we are a very high art city, but we don't, I guess living here, we don't always think of it that
right,
way.
Yeah.
How do you find new people? Do you how do you recruit, I guess is the word, of
for every band member we convert, we get a toaster oven.
Yes, yes, that's the Ellen joke. Yes.
It's word of mouth, finding out through through our advertisements and Outsmarter, through friends of friends. We're trying to diversify our outreach methods.
Yeah, I mean, it's just important to know that it's not just a group of just musicians who are gay and lesbian. I mean, they're all just to support the idea. And I mean, a good majority, number of our members are not gay at all. So
it's a good, really diverse crowd. It really makes it like one big family because you have people from all walks of life, and it's not just kind of pigeonholed into the gay and lesbian community, even though that is our primary outreach.
Do the people who join, are they people who've like played all the time, or are people that may have like stopped and then come back and say, hey, this is something I want to do, or is it just a total mixture?
It's a total mixture, I believe.
We have people that that have learned how to play in the band, and we've had people, we actually have a member that just got back from going to grad school in London for performance. So, we have some amazing talent in the group, and
how do you balance that? I mean, I mean, you want to be open to everybody. At the same time, you also want to have sort of a professional performance, right?
I think we try to keep it fun and not take ourselves too seriously, but so we play a diverse music, so everything from show tunes to, you know, more standard repertoire, right. Stuff that's easier to stuff that's harder, because that way we can make people who aren't, that don't have that ability or that level as some of the others, they still feel like they're accomplishing something and they're happy. And then the folks that have a little bit more skill, that they can still feel challenged at times as well. And so it just kind of making sure we try to please all sides of the aisle.
And how much of an investment do the members have to put in time and energy and...
As much as we can get out of them without running them off, I guess.
Do you have weekly or monthly? How do you practice sessions?
We rehearse every Wednesday at Bethel Church, 7:30 to 9:30.
About 2 hours a week. Periodically, we'll take breaks. You know, after a concert, I'll tend to give our group a week off so they can kind of sit back and detox from music, and we can get started on something else.
And how do you decide what to play at a concert? How does that all work?
No, we determine the season the beginning of the year, which is usually after the Pride Parade when the season starts. And we pick themes, then we go with the themes for the concerts and pick music from that.
We've started also kind of soliciting some input from the band members at different times for programs to see what people... what they like to play, and then also to try to find out, you know, what people are talking to them about, what our audience likes to listen to. So we look at it from all different angles, so it's not just, you know, either one of us saying that this is what we want to do. We want to see what everybody enjoys doing as well.
Right.
And you ever try to collaborate with other bands or vocal groups?
Well, it's funny you said that. We're in the process right now of joining or creating a relationship with the BCPA, the governing board of the Gay Men's Chorus and the Women's Chorus, and that's in the process right now. Next season, we're going to have a group season package to offer. It's going to be part band, part chorus, to kind of solidify that that relationship.
And the Gay Men's Chorus has come and performed on a couple of our concerts,
and we've gone to perform some of their stuff before too. So
great.
So trying to keep it in the family, I guess.
It just makes sense that we work together.
Yeah.
Well, certainly the Pride Band has had a long history in Houston and marching in the parades from I guess almost the very beginning, mm-hmm. And I know Andy Mills just talked about the time that you all went to, and I know it's before your time, went to the Hollywood Bowl. He talked to it for like 2 years because that was such a big thing of bringing all the bands together, because the band was really a pioneering organization in this community.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been really fortunate to be, I think we're one of the two longest or oldest gay and lesbian bands in the country.
Wow.
Having been in existence since 1978, I believe. I think the only other group that's been there around longer is in San Francisco. And so where we hit our 30-year anniversary several years ago, organizations around the country are just now hitting their 25 or their 30-year anniversaries, and they're sending out emails to everybody saying, hey, come to our 30th anniversary concert. And we're like, well, we've already done that.
And how does Houston compare to some of the other cities in the amount of members and the professionalism and the working together?
All the bands and all the members that I've met from all over the country, some bands are larger, some bands have more, they have more members, some have less, but there's always a really good mix, I think, from everybody. I know that Washington, D.C. and New York both have really large bands, and they have great people in there. But we have just as, you know, some really talented musicians, and we play some of the same music that they do, even though they're a much larger band. So it's not really a competition between all of us, but it's a little friendly competition. It's like, oh yeah, we played that last concert or something like that, and compare notes on different things. And so it's really kind of neat. But it's a pretty even mix all across the country, I think.
Do y'all have a lot of fun doing this?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I mean, being a community organization, we're not doing it for profit or for pay. It's really for the sheer joy of doing something like this and getting to make music and the camaraderie from our band members and stuff like that. So it's worth it.
And as the next generation's coming up, you know, we all have computers. We all can sort of somehow create music on computers somehow. Are people still learning how to play musical instruments?
Yeah, that'll never die. It would never, ever
really?
Die. I don't think so.
Wow.
I mean, it may not be as prevalent, you may not have as many people trying to go professional with it, but there are going to be, I mean, just the sheer number of community or music organizations here in Houston that I've seen, there's just a huge amount of people who still play piano, or they'll still noodle on their clarinet or flute or something rather, and they'll find an outlet for it here or there, whether it's in a, you know, small little chamber group where they just kind of get together and do a little jam session, or be part of a band or an orchestra that's much larger, and they're just kind of another piece of the puzzle.
Okay, so when is your concert coming up?
This coming Saturday, June 11th at 7:30 at Zilker Hall at the Hobby Center.
Now, we can't mention ticket prices, but how does somebody get a ticket? If
you can go to our website,
HoustonPrideBand.org.
Sorry. And there's a link there that will bring you to the box office at the Hobby Center. Or you can go to thehobbycenter.org and you can order it there. Call the box office person, or you can buy them at the door.
And if somebody wants to get involved in the organization, how could they?
Website again, just go to the website. You can contact us that way.
And, you know, a lot of times people want to know, you know, how close to a concert or something like that, but really people can just kind of show up to rehearsal,
right.
We have the times that we rehearse. It's usually every Wednesday. We rehearse at Bethel United Church of Christ at Washington, at the near the intersection of Washington and Shepherd. I think the address is 1107 Shepherd. And if I get that wrong, then I'm gonna hear about that tomorrow. But
it's on the website, right?
But it's on the website, and along with the address and the times that we rehearse and all that kind of stuff.
Well, Skip and Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And we're talking about the Pride Band, which is having its concert this Saturday at
Zilker Hall,
downtown Houston, at the Hobby Center. And you're listening to Queer Voices.
You'll hear a couple of voices associated with a new movie and the story of a man with a voice like no other. But first, conservative voices in favor of marriage equality are being heard more and more often. In Iowa, former state senator Jeff Angelo is launching a group he calls Iowa Republicans for Freedom to encourage his party's rank and file to support the right of same-gender couples to marry. As a vote in the New York State Legislature nears, the ACLU is helping to shift the traditional lines of scrimmage there.
There's a big political fight in New York State. What are the big Republican Party donors up to now?
I'm Frances Crowe, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute.
The New York State Assembly would easily pass, and Governor Andrew Cuomo would sign, a marriage equality bill. But the state Senate, controlled by Republicans, killed that legislation 2 years ago and could well do it again. In response, to try to change some votes with television ads and grassroots organizing, Republican donors known for bankrolling right-leaning candidates and causes have contributed over $1 million to gay rights organizations fighting for marriage equality. The reason? The New York Times quotes wealthy financier donor Clifford Asness as saying, "I'm a pretty straight-down-the-line small government guy. This is an issue of basic freedom." Likewise, wealthy donor Stephen Cohen says, "We believe in social justice for all Americans. There are business reasons for their support and personal reasons, too." Prominent hedge fund manager and contributor Paul Singer has a gay son who married his partner in Massachusetts. So, this year, New York State may enact marriage equality, in part, and to the surprise of some, because of the efforts and money of rich, conservative Republicans.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom cannot defend itself.
A Quinnipiac University poll released this week found 58% of New York State voters approving of marriage equality. Whether their state senators will follow suit remains to be seen. Reportedly, 8 more votes are needed for the same-gender marriage legislation to pass the Senate, and the final day of the current session is June 20th.
Harvey Fierstein's voice, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Born in Brooklyn in 1954, Harvey Fierstein came out at age 13. He loved going to Saturday matinees on Broadway and even play-acted in drag as Ethel Merman. Harvey graduated from Pratt Institute in 1973, aspiring to become a painter, but soon turned to playwriting. His award-winning show, Torch Song Trilogy, was first presented off-Broadway in 1981, with him in the lead role. The awards were piling up, especially after hitting Broadway. Harvey has long been a champion of GLBT rights. Brought into sharper focus by Matthew Shepard's murder, he spoke out with his characteristic husky voice, rallying the community to speak out, to vote, and to boycott. In one inspiring speech, he reached out to the community saying, "We are not different. We are extraordinary." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Sonia of Disappear Fear.
Texas, and I was delivering pizzas for Pizza Hut. There was a radio show that would come on.
Singer-songwriter Ryan State.
And they would talk about out music. And I had never even thought of it. It never even occurred to me. And they were talking about songwriters and performers and how they wouldn't switch the pronouns. They wouldn't compromise. They sounded very fearless to me, and then I started thinking, well, why don't I just write music that's out Yeah, I wish I wish I could have thought of it on my own, but it was definitely definitely eye-opening and very liberating, and it was at a time when I was just coming out to myself. And so I thought it was really important because I thought that there was an absence of that in the culture, and I felt very isolated because of that, I think. I was listening to This Way Out, and so I was actually inspired by the radio to do Out Music.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
When your elderly parent calls to say they've got something to tell you, don't assume they're talking about their gout or their leaky faucet. You may be in for the kind of surprise that was waiting for screenwriter-director Mike Mills, whose new film gets a thumbs up from This Way Out's Steve Pride.
Beginners is not simply inspired by the life of writer-director Mike Mills. It virtually runs parallel to it, in that Mike's parents, like the folks in the movie, were married for 45 years. And following his mom's death, his dad, at age 75, came out and reinvented his life. Ewan McGregor plays the son, and Christopher Plummer, the dad. But the real star of the film is the story. And while thematically, it's not all that original or brave to say that life is racing by and you'd better make the most of it, this film is infused with originality and courage.
My mom died in like June of 99, and it was Thanksgiving when he came out to me. The day before, he said, "Michael, I'm going to throw you a ball tomorrow and I hope you catch it." And I thought he was going to want to move in with me or something because he felt very much the widow. He felt very 75. He felt very old. I was buying his clothes. I was helping him learn how to defrost food from Trader Joe's. You know, it was like that life. And then he said, you know, he said, "I'm gay." And like in the movie, he said, "And I don't want to be just theoretically gay. I want to do something about it. Meaning I want to have sex. I want to have boyfriends. I want to go out."
Oliver?
Yeah.
I'm not sorry I woke you.
I went to Akbar tonight.
You did?
Yeah, oh, they had some wonderfully loud
music. What kind of music's that?
Probably house music.
House music. Okay. House music.
He was very worried about what me and my sisters would think, but it was nice to have him want to be alive. That was my main concern, you know. My mom dying was really a shattering, huge experience for all of us, including my dad. And that he not only was alive, that he wanted to be alive, but he wanted to be more alive, that he wanted something, was pretty amazing. He was so self-denying, you know, he was so, in that generation, is so self-denying.
For a deeply closeted man, life is a performance. So in a way, you didn't really know your dad until he was 75. What was he like when you were a kid?
He was a very sweet man, right? And he was very kind, and my parents were very dedicated to each other. We didn't have some like wildly dysfunctional family, but within that somewhat normal, committed family, there was like a ton of loneliness. You know, I think between my parents and a level of my parents were very lonely with themselves and the world and me with them. And I think my dad was this kind of like, on some key, central, deep level, he had to turn so much of himself off, and he did it. Like, he internalized the homophobia and turned it off. But I think none of us knew how much other peripheral energy and spirit he turned off when he turned off his sexuality, when he turned off his gayness. And I feel like I had a very polite relationship with this man who was kind, but we didn't really get into stuff very much. And also, there's a huge generation gap between us. He's born in 24, I'm born in 66. We're quite different in many ways. But I never would have explained it quite like that until after he came out and I met this new guy who was way more engaged, way more willing to argue, way less polite, and all in good ways. And just more sort of hot and present and complicated. So in that way, I feel like I got to know him much better. And I really do think it's like, it's his gayness for sure, or accepting it, or accepting his full self, or, and finally being with guys. He was just so hungry to be around other gay men and like be mirrored and be able to tell his story and hear store and talk like that, just talk gay community talk, you know. But it was also, I think, it has to do with, you know, my mom was, they were friends since junior high. And whatever the complicated world they shared together, they were, at the very least, great friends, great old friends. Or people had raised children together, shared their lives. When my mom died, it was a big deal for my dad. And I think grief not just makes you sad, but it makes you really grab on to life, or it makes you really go for things that you haven't gone for. So I think even his coming out, even his emotional availability that was new, is in some weird ways part of like the fear that my mom's death shoved into his life. Like, I only have so much time. I gotta communicate with my son. I gotta be my real self. I gotta do all this.
Having grown up without the example of real love between his parents, Mike later had trouble forming real relationships with women. A great deal of the film is about his finally learning to love from the example of his now emotionally liberated father. And according to Ewan McGregor, who plays Oliver, a.k.a. Mike Mills, in this film,
it was an interesting exploration of that, of course. The idea that the relationship that you're first party to is your parents' relationship, and how does that affect your ability to then go on and successfully have your own relationships or not?
Well, maybe you should take out a personal ad, you know, where you can explain your situation.
What situation?
Yeah. I mean, you want to be in a relationship and you can't stand one.
That's your fatherly advice, personal ads.
Well, a lot of people use them. I did.
What?
If Andy wasn't going to be monogamous, why should I be?
Mike, a good deal of the film deals with your father's cancer diagnosis after coming out and his physical decline. So as joyous as his life became, there's an overriding sadness about the lost years. And let's be honest, it's not easy to be a gay senior.
Well, yeah, or just, and the gay community isn't totally easy to figure out or enter into, and it has its own culture and ethics and rules and etiquette. And my dad had to learn all these things, and often that was quite frustrating or hurtful. You can imagine how much he wanted to be part of the community, how much he wanted to have relationships, and yet he didn't know all the rules of a scene that does have rules, you know, or does have ways. And then you can imagine he finally comes out at 75. He wants to have sex. He has crushes on all these younger guys. And you know, it's very unlikely that younger gay guys have crushes on older gay guys. Or, you know, I think that's an issue for heterosexuals and gay people. That age is so, can become seen as like a ugly detriment in a weird way, or scary, right? So that was heartbreaking in lots of ways.
Since I cried during the trailer, it's hard for me to imagine you watching actors on the set reenacting such a personal story.
Obviously, there's all this real love there. And not just my love for my dad, but my dad's last years were so much about love and loving himself, loving his friends, loving his, you know, being in love. So that's all great. But making a film about all this is so different than living it. Christopher Plummer is so different than my dad. Ewan is so different than me. So from my experience, it's really not like so crazily personal. It's me directing. It's me being a writer-director. It's me telling a story. It's me with my crew who I love, my actors. I adore actors. I love being around people. It's kind of like the way Hal is with Andy. I love being around these juicier, messier, more expressive people, you know?
And what does Mike's doppelganger, Ewan McGregor, hope audiences take away from the story?
I really wouldn't like to say, because I think it's really the kind of film that everybody would have a different experience seeing. It's very much about our relationship with our parents, how that affects who we are, how we fall in love, being in love, and deals very much with acceptance, accepting people for who they are.
And according to writer-director Mike Mills,
to me, the irreducible emotional nugget at the bottom of all this is my dad's willingness to make himself vulnerable to get love, you know? And that was really inspiring to watch, be it gay or straight or whatever. But at that age, when you're that set, and when you're going against that much fear, you know, that he reached out anyways and went for it. And if my film can somehow be the communication device of that energy, I would be happy.
This has been a conversation with writer-director Mike Mills and his film counterpart, Ewan McGregor. Beginners is a Focus Features release. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend a lonely night dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you when our love was new. And each kiss an inspiration. Oh, but that was long ago. Now my consolation is in.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Michael LeBeau, Steve Pride, and Judd Proctor, Brian Burns, and Disappear Fears' Sonia contributed program material. Thanks also to Ryan Stage, J.D. Doyle, Bill Newman, and the ACLU of Massachusetts. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and the generosity of our supporting listeners. Find out more at thiswayout.org, where you can read news wrap, see what we look like, and check out our podcasts, our blog, and our Facebook fan page. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm... Thanks for listening on WRUW Cleveland, Ohio, KVSC St. Cloud, Minnesota, 3UGE Alexandria, Victoria, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. Listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Hi, this is Gus Gottesman, inviting you to our fifth annual benefit dance for KPFT, Friday, June the 10th, 2011, at the Blue Island Hall, 3336 Frick Road, over Houston, Texas, performing live on stage. Jimmy Lee, Los Monarcas, Mickey y sus Carnales. Doors open at 7. Be sure to get there early. Donations only $10 all night long, 21 and up only. Bring your own bottle. How's that? For more information, 281-992-600. See you there.
This is KPFT Houston.
Weekday at 9, KPFT features programming by you. It's called Open Journal, and it's an experiment in truly community radio. On Open Journal, regular listeners just like you come into KPFT studios to host their own programs. Sometimes it's talk, sometimes it's music, but it's always unique. Open Journal airs weekdays at 9 a.m. right after BBC headlines. The community spotlight at 9:30 is here for you. Open Journal is what community radio is all about. You can even participate and host your own Open Journal. Just drop by KPFT's website at kpft.org to download an Open Journal application. We provide the help, you provide the knowledge. Tune in to Open Journal at 9 a.m. weekdays. This is KPFT Houston.